Well, first, apropos Tony's remark, electrons in molecules form a cloud. They do form a cloud. And there is more to it. And the curious thing about density functional theory is you can, with some justification, say there is very little more to it, or you can also say there's very much more to it, and both of those statements are correct, and I hope you see what I mean by this. So this is, of course, the colloquium of the Institute for Theoretical Physics. By the way, I'm using pretty much the same material that I used a couple of weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, when I gave my formal, it was not very formal, but I mean it fulfilled a formal purpose. If one gets a Nobel Prize, one has to give a lecture in Stockholm. And I've done that. And you're going to hear pretty much the same. Now, the lecture that I gave was to a different audience, which I think many of you have picked up the curious fact that I got the Nobel Prize in chemistry, and the audience was sort of half physics, half chemistry. And therefore, I thought, before I get into the usual kind of thing that we physicists do, equations and stuff, I should start by showing something that would, number one, to some extent, what shall I say, indicate that perhaps I at least know a bond when I see one, and secondly, would not immediately lose me half the audience. So I started with pictures, and I'm going to do the same here, perhaps a little untypical for our seminars. And the pictures, the first picture is taken not only from a chemistry journal, but it is taken from a journal of applied chemistry. Okay? So be broad-minded. There we are. So what you see there, let's see, what's a good way to point? There. This was given to me, by the way, by these gentlemen. This is an Austro-Swiss collaboration. And you see here methanol, that's this molecule here, inside a zeolite. Zeolite is a crystal. And what you see here is a cage, and the crystal consists of a crystal of cages. And you see one of the cages here, and you see methanol, a molecule inside. And you see here is I will not go into that much detail, but this putting methanol into a zeolite is the first step in a catalytic process that eventually leads to gasoline. Now, I won't follow that up any further except to give you the impression, the correct impression, that density functional theory, which resulted in this picture and in more that I'll describe to you, is now a very, very practically useful theory. Probably Mr. Nobel would be pleased to hear that, because it's in his will The prize should be given to people who do something useful. It almost never is. So this is a still picture. I think the picture itself is pretty self-explanatory. You have silicon and an oxygen framework. You have here this methanol, and you have a substitution at the bottom which is essential, namely there's an aluminum that is substitutes for silicon, and the action takes place in this area. What I'd like to draw your attention to is the fact that you have here order of magnitude something like 50 or 100 different atoms. This is in fact a still from a beautiful video that I've seen that Mr. Schwartz showed me, where you see such a methanol in the cage at finer temperature. You see this very large system in thermal fluctuations. You can see with your eyes simply, and it's so to speak true to life, except you're using your expanding time, of course. You can see the chemical processes taking place in front of your eyes. This is my first example then of applications of density functional theory, and I will say this several times now, to systems consisting of very many atoms, applications that were not possible prior to the development of density functional theory. Give you two or three more pictures, which I think are nice. The next one is from our local group, the group working with Horia Mettu, who I think is out of town today. This is again a technically important material. The chemical formula is written here, perhaps not very well visible. Strontium 8, gallium 16, germanium 30. The picture attempts to show you both the geometric structure, that's pretty obvious. Let me pull it down now so that you see which atom is which. Both the geometric structure, which you see here, and what you see here is a color coded indication of what the electronic structure is in the mid-plane. Again, this is a technically important material for its electrical properties. And if you just know a little elementary chemistry, the question arises very quickly when you see this chemical formula: is this a metal or an insulator? If each strontium atom, strontium is divalent, gives up one of the electrons to the framework consisting of gallium and germanium, if it gives up two electrons to this framework, then it makes the framework insulating. If it gives up only one electron, it would be metallic. And this material is an important thermoelectric material, but the electronic structure was not understood until a calculation of this kind could be made, and it has now turned out, in fact, that not all the two electrons per strontium atom are given up to the framework, and therefore this system is metallic, and not only the structural properties of this material, but also the electrical properties could be calculated and agree very well with the experiment. Another picture from another group. It's the group of Wanda Andreoni in Zurich, IBM Zurich. And here you see, of course, the popular buckyball, and which has again a big hollow, and of course we see again number of atoms is in the range of 50 to 100. And the question was, where does the lanthanum sit? Is an important question because it is very decisive in understanding its the chemistry that goes on. And the answer was not uninteresting. The uninteresting answers would have been if it sits in the middle or that it attaches itself to the side, as you saw the methanol does. But in fact, there is apparently a minimum energy surface somewhere around here, and it diffuses around. And a last picture also from Wanda Andreoni's group. This is another fullerene, C82, and you see here a cross section, and you introduce lanthanum in there, and it does something quite different. It attaches itself to the wall. So this just to kind of warm you up to show you what kinds of uses density functional theory is being put to. Now I'll start the talk itself. I'll give a little sort of historical feeling for the background. And then you notice in the title I put wave functions and density functionals. Now I was uncertain whether I should say wave functions versus density functionals, but I think this is the much better word. And I'll try and explain what I mean by that. After the history, I then will draw particular attention to a feature of Schrödinger wave functions for systems consisting of very many electrons. And just to say it right away, it runs into great problems when you're dealing with systems of many electrons. And then I will, in paragraph 3, that's really the main body of this colloquium, I'll try and explain density functional theory and why it is interesting to note this banal fact that electrons and molecules are clouds. So the historical, very brief historical introduction. I go back to the late 20s, and there were two beginnings. One, the Schrödinger equation. We're talking about systems of many electrons. So here is the wave function of, if I have n electrons, of 3n variables. So unbelievably powerful equation. I say in principle arbitrarily accurate, that by arbitrarily, I mean, of course, once you accept the non-relativistic limit and the Born-Oppenheimer approximation and so on. And I mention to those of you who haven't heard it that, and I've never found a place where this was actually recorded, but I've repeatedly heard it said that after the Schrödinger equation was proposed, and perhaps after the first application to chemistry was made, that Dirac said, well, all of chemistry is in this equation, chemistry has come to an end, except that unfortunately we can't solve this equation. So this was really represented a monumental step in 20th century science, both chemistry and physics. Now, another development, which I should have written in much smaller letters, if I would be able to do that with my pen, was the Thomas Fermi theory. Much smaller letters because its impact on science, both physics and chemistry, was absolutely minuscule compared to that of the Schrödinger equation. Thomas and Fermi, just to say it very simply, regarded any system of or any agglomeration of atoms and molecules with electrons, of course, regarded the electrons in the vicinity of any particular point like an uniform electron gas in the vicinity of that point, characterized only by its local density. So obviously a very crude model, very intelligent model. You have to be as enterprising and bright as Thomas or Fermi to have the courage to say that. It was certainly very valuable and gave very rough guidelines very rough insight into the structure of atoms. By rough, I mean with an accuracy, just to put it very crudely, on the order of 50 to 100%. But in atoms, this theory ran into problems, both at the edges and also at the nucleus, where there is a singular behavior. And there were many simple systems that couldn't be treated at all in a sensible way. For example, atomic ions, the theory just did not have a solution. The theory ran into big troubles at the edges. That was the main trouble with the ions. So here we have two very different starting points. This really goes back to Sommerfeld and Pauli, electron gas type of picture, whereas here is a very complete description of all the intricacies of interacting electrons. Now, since that time, the late 20s, most of the progress by far was derived from the Schrödinger equation. And I mention here just quickly, just by name, Hilleras, who used the Schrödinger equation for the first use of the Schrödinger equation for a many electron system, many in this case being two, the helium atom, and was able to describe the total ionization energy of the helium atom with a high level of accuracy, I don't know, something like four or five places at the time. In the meantime, of course, that can be done very, very much better. That was a very important step because, as you will remember, the hydrogen atom with just one electron, the main features could be very successfully described without the Schrödinger equation, just by the Bohr quantization rules. But an enormous effort went into trying to extend that approach to systems with more than one electron, and failed until the Schrödinger equation came along. So the fact that now Hilleras, using this equation, got this tremendous accuracy was historically of great importance. Other developments, all coming from the Schrödinger equation, were the Hartree equations, the Haeckel-London, Bloch-Mollikon, James Coolidge approach to molecular structure, the concept of the chemical bond due to Pauling, Hartree-Fock equation, plus so-called configuration interactions. I'll say a little more about that later. And that line, as far as I can judge, sort of reached its peak, its practical peak at least, in terms of practical applicability in the work of John Popper, who was my partner in this Nobel Prize, although we did different and quite separate work. Popper did his important work entirely in conjunction with computers, so he took great advantage of the growing power of computers. Now, what happened to this starting point? There were several corrections applied to the original Thomas Fermi theory, exchange, correlation, gradient corrections. They did not really help very much. The theory was still very crude. In particular, for chemists, it was very disappointing that the theory gave absolutely no molecular binding at all. So it was not, did not seem a promising starting point for chemistry. Since the theory was a heuristic theory and had no firm basis, the computers were not terribly helpful because you didn't really know what you should compute. So whereas computers really made an enormous difference in the work that started from Schrödinger, it made almost no difference in the work that came out of the Thomas Fermi theory. So that's the general quick historical overview. And now I'm going to talk about Schrödinger wave functions, and I'm going to discuss particularly the difference in the applicability of Schrödinger theory to systems with few electrons versus systems with many electrons. And then when I come to density functional theory, I'll be pointing out to you that that's a very different story, this few versus many electrons in density functional theory. So, I don't think I really need to spend any time on this. This is the Schrödinger equation, attraction between electrons and nuclei, electron-electron repulsion. Here's the wave function. I think nowhere in these notes do I speak about spin. Of course, it needs to be included, but it's not necessary to understand the essence of what I'm trying to talk about here. you get an energy eigenvalue that depends parametrically on the position of the nuclei. Use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, consider these fixed. All the other quantities depend parametrically on the nuclei, and then of course if you are interested in vibrations or things of that sort, this energy, which is now a function of the nuclear position, becomes an effective potential energy for the motion of the nuclei. Well, I'm going to be quite brief here. In fact, I want to just convey some general ideas about Schrödinger theory for systems of few electrons. And the hydrogen molecule is the simplest one that's also of interest to chemists, and many of you will remember the Heitler-London approximation, a very simple approximation that puts views a hydrogen molecule in the following way, that you have one electron sitting on one atom, the other one on the other atom. The spins are opposite, but then you make them into a singlet. And that very simple notion, I think one could argue, was the beginning of 20th century chemistry. Here, perhaps not so clearly visible, are the results. The two probably most important quantities are the binding energies, the dissociation energy, experimentally about 4.75 volts, in this very simple approximation, 3.14 volts. So it's beginning to be semi-quantitative. Similar for the equilibrium separation, experimentally 0.74 angstroms, Heitler-London gives 0.87 angstroms. So this is a picture where the electrons are viewed as sitting on one or the other atom. This direction of work has continued to the present day. Name has just escaped me. Who's our colleague at Caltech?
Bill Goddard.
Bill Goddard at Caltech has developed this very effectively. Okay, another point of view, the Bloch-Mulliken molecular orbitals. Again, we're talking about the hydrogen atom, but now we visualize a single orbital, which in fact is just the sum of two localized hydrogen orbitals, and placing each of the electrons in the same orbital, but again in a singlet state. So one will spin up and one will spin down and anti-symmetrized. Again, the numbers are actually somewhat worse, but in the same ballpark. For the distance, about the same. For the binding energy, it's somewhat worse. I don't know if my chemistry colleagues here would agree, but it's my impression that this approach, although here the numbers are a little bit worse, has really been the more influential approach in chemistry than the valence bond orbitals, although they both have been very fruitful. Okay. Hartree-Fock, very important, still dominates a great deal of quantum chemistry. You replace this simple Bloch-Mulliken wave function, which is just the sum of the heterogenic wave function, by a general wave function that's symmetric, and then you symmetric in the two atoms, and then you do the appropriate anti-symmetrizing, write down a single determinant, of course, because of the Pauli principle, involving this one unknown orbital. You take the expectation value of the Hamiltonian in this determinantal wave function, and you vary this single orbital to get a minimum. When you do this, this minimization procedure leads to the so-called Hartree-Fock equations. And the results are again sort of similar to the ones that we had already obtained. Now at this point I want to just mention for the non-chemists here what is meant by these configuration interaction calculations. Hartree-Fock is very often used as a starting point for more elaborate calculations in which one minimizes the energy not in a trial function consisting of just one determinant, but consisting of more than one determinant. I have been at a meeting of theoretical chemists where a calculation was described involving, I think, a billion determinants. Each one of these determinants is then considered a configuration, and of course the different determinants are coupled by the Hamiltonian, so there's a configuration interaction. It's the practical perfection of that scheme that is, of course, innumerable people have contributed to it, but probably John Popper is the one of the most successful and one of the best known. There was a calculation in the 30s, I believe. I actually still knew both of these people. James and Coolidge at Harvard. And what they did was they took a general symmetric wave function in two variables. This is the spin function, a singlet function, and they minimize the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with respect to this function. And now, for the first time, they got really quantitative agreement with experiment for the hydrogen molecule. That was the significance of that work. This, you see, is still very rough. So I've talked about the hydrogen molecule as the simplest example of a molecule consisting of few atoms. But I want to now begin to lead into the discussion of what happens when you have many atoms. So let's do a little counting. The number of variables here is 6, one for each of the electrons. But there is some symmetry, and that reduces it to 5. And now let's just ask ourselves, before we imagine that we start a calculation, how big a calculation is that going to be? Well, you have altogether 5 variables. You want to do a variational calculation. So in one way or another, you have to introduce a sufficiently flexible wave function. And if you say that for each variable, imagine a wave function, although nobody would do it that way, written as a Fourier series. So then if you want to be able to fit the behavior of the wave function in each variable, you might say accurately, you might say, well, perhaps I need 10 Fourier components for each dimension. But since you have 5 dimensions, you right away have altogether 10 to the 5 Fourier components. In the time of James and Coolidge, it was completely impossible to handle that, of course. They probably used perhaps hand-operated computer. Of course, at this point, human intelligence comes into this, and so if you choose these variables with some insight as to what you might expect, then perhaps you can use just 3 functions per variable, and then you have 3 to the 5, which is 250. And so now you get into the range of the possible. But notice this exponent. That's an important point of my talk. Magnitude of the theoretical problem rises exponentially in the number of dimensions of the problem. Before I go further into that, I want to sort of conclude now by saying that the James and Coolidge calculation has, of course, also been redone. I don't know what's the latest, but I saw something perhaps done 20 years later. And at that point, with better computers, at that point, the agreement with experiment was perfect. Perfect in the sense that a better agreement is of no further significant interest. The equilibrium position was determined to something after one makes the necessary corrections, but never mind. It was determined to something better than a hundredth of an angstrom, and the binding energy, which, as you remember, was on the order of 4 volts, was determined to something better than a hundredth of a volt. So the conclusion I want to draw at this point is that for sufficiently small molecules, the wave function methods give excellent results. And now I come to many electrons. And I call this fighting an exponential wall. So let's do just a little rough arithmetic. I have n electrons, and I, let's say, use new functions per variable. And I have a certain maximum basis that I can in reality deal with, which I'll call capital N max. And now we ask ourselves, what is the maximum number, manageable number of electrons? Well, this is the total number of different dimensions. I have new such functions per dimension, and I equate that to n max. And now you see, to answer my question, what's the maximum number of electrons I can deal with, this is the answer. And so here we see the logarithm, which is the inverse of the exponential, and you see that the maximum number of electrons rises logarithmically with the number of with the size of your basis. So if you take your basis to be a billion, for example, and you say you are using three functions per variable, well, then you come out with the conclusion that the maximum number of electrons is 7. Don't take that number seriously in the sense that in this connection, when I say 7, I don't distinguish between 7 and 70, but I distinguish between 7 and 7,000, okay? So what you see here is that you need a lot of chemical ingenuity in order to vastly reduce the required basis from our estimate. This is the perfectly ignorant estimate. But the exponential dependence of the maximum number of electrons that you can handle on the basis, that remains. And therefore, this argument is perhaps not by itself convincing, but it perhaps gives you at least the general idea. The conclusion here is the practical conclusion reached by theoretical chemists, that traditional wave function methods are limited to small values of n. Now, to continue, I'm going to put before you some, I started saying calling them metaphysical thoughts, but since I'm now a chemist, I put metachemical in parentheses. And this is related to an observation by Van Vleck, who was one of my teachers, by the way. He did not say this, and so I don't. I call this a provocative statement. First of all, he was not a provocative kind of person. In any case, this is a very debatable statement, and I don't want to pin it on him. And I don't necessarily want to pin it on myself either. But I remark here, and will try to show you why I make this remark, that in general, the many electron wave function for a number of electrons exceeding a certain limit, which is of the order of 1,000. Again, by 1,000 I mean something between 100 and 10,000. That it is not a legitimate scientific concept. Now, why do I say that? It's a rather ridiculous statement, sort of just looked at, but I think perhaps you'll see there's some interesting questions behind it. We need some kind of figure of merit for an approximate wave function. We can never get an exact wave function, of course. So we want a good approximate wave function. What do we mean by that? Well, it should have, if you're remaining entirely within the framework of, within the conceptual framework of wave functions, then I think you're driven to something like this, to say that the inner product of the approximate wave function with the exact wave function, which I'll call gamma, or 1 minus alpha, should be, this inner product should be close to 1. Well, that requires that alpha, for example, be less than 0.1. 90% overlap. Is such a thing even conceivable? And I'm going to indicate to you that it's not when the number of electrons exceeds this 10 to the third or so. The first argument is that when n exceeds this critical number, n naught, then a good psi approximate, good in this sense, cannot be calculated. And I'll take a very simple example. I'll take separated atoms, non-interacting with each other, but interacting, the electrons on each atom are interacting. So then I have a product wave function, for the moment, let's just assume that each of these atoms is, it's a product wave function, and these R's really refer to all the electrons on the particular, in the particular atom 1 here, for example. And then you have to, of course, even though they are not interacting, you must antisymmetrize. That's unimportant for our purposes. Now, an approximate wave function, then, for this system of separated atoms, you'd have to, of course, introduce an approximation into the wave function for atom 1, for atom 2, for atom n. And so these are the approximate wave functions for the individual atoms. Excuse me. So here's the figure of merit for the wave function of a given atom, and let's say it's very accurately calculated. So this alpha, is the overlap is nearly one, so this is much less than one. Well, now for the many electron wave functions, the overlap, simply because you're working in these many dimensions, is then the product of these gammas. Now, as all of you will know, and it's just worked out here, if each of these alphas is just, let's say, 10 to the minus 2, when I take a product of 0.99 and raise it to the power of 1,000, you get a very small number. That's what's worked out here. And what you see here is that if you want the total wave function to have an overlap of 0.9 in this example, you need an accuracy of the approximately 10 to the minus 4 for the individual wave function, simply because that number here occurs in the exponential, and that's just not possible. You can get the individual atomic wave functions very accurately, but not to that kind of an accuracy. So this was for non-interacting atoms. For strongly interacting atoms, the situation is much worse. The argument two is of a different kind. One just makes the observation that suppose you could calculate it in some way, could you ever record it? And the answer is, of course not. So a little bit of playing around, and again, don't take these numbers seriously, that you'd need something like 10 to the 2,000 bits. So you can't calculate it and you can't record it. And that was the sense in which I made this provocative statement earlier, that it's not a legitimate scientific concept. If it is in principle not calculable to any kind of accuracy, I mean, if I take one of these complicated systems that I showed you there, let's say this buckyball with a lanthanum, and if you can calculate a wave function, the very best wave function would have an overlap of 10 to the minus some enormous power with the correct wave function.
But why is that a physical criteria? Why is it not expectation?
We'll discuss it. Yeah. I'm discussing it right now. So I want to, however, point out, just summarize, even the best approximate wave function have a negligible overlap with the exact wave function. Nevertheless, very bad approximate wave functions, bad in that sense. Of course, we all know that they can be used successfully to calculate quantities which depend on only a few variables near each other, such as density, correlation functions, total energy, forces on nuclei, and so on. Now, so what's the problem? The problem is that one shouldn't be carried away by this nevertheless either. This doesn't mean that any bad wave function is going to give you good results. You don't need to have good wave functions in that sense to get good results, but what is the criterion within the conceptual framework of wave functions that determines whether a wave function does or does not give you good results? Now, that is a problem which I consider to be very interesting and not really clarified. I did write something preliminary about it a couple of years ago, but this kind of question, this, which was the purpose of my making the provocative statement, needs a lot more thought, in my opinion. Before I immediately come to density functional theory, while we're still talking about wave functions, I want to introduce density functional theory in this negative sense by saying it avoids the use of many electron wave functions. Introduction to density functional theory. So, this I've already been through, but there is a subtle difference from the way I've written this Schrödinger equation to the way I wrote it before. Before, I had here the interaction with the nuclei. Now, in order to develop density functional theory, you must do something that many of you may have encountered in your own work. You have to replace the problem that nature poses for you, atoms in interaction with each other, by a broader problem which lends itself to better mathematical development. So I have here, instead of the interaction with the external nuclei, I've written here a general external potential V of Rj. For atoms, it has this form, but I'm going to consider this equation with a general V. And okay, what is written here I have already explained. Now, density functional theory reformulates the problem of solving the 3n dimensional Schrödinger equation for this 3n dimensional wave function in terms of a problem involving the 3 dimensional electron density n of r for any value of the number of electrons. That's the is a radically different point of view. So here is a density distribution, and density functional theory deals with this function of 3 variables, whether you have a hydrogen atom or whether you have one of these complicated structures that I started out with.
The one electron density.
It's the one electron density. Right. Now this leads me to mention with great appreciation my first collaborator, Pierre Hohenberg. And perhaps a few words about how we sort of got into this in the first place. I was on sabbatical leave in Paris. That's already a great plus for doing good work. And was working on something quite practical. I was interested in some questions of metallic disorder, and looked at the literature. I had been teaching earlier in Pittsburgh, where there was one of the country's strongest departments of metallurgy. Pittsburgh was, of course, the steel capital of the United States. And so I had I knew a little bit about metallurgy. Actually, not that much. I knew some metallurgists quite well. In any case, I thought, well, if I'm trying to understand something about this order, I should look at the metallurgical literature, and I did that. And I noticed that metallurgists, really in this more spirit of Thomas and Fermi, they talked a lot about about, well, yes, fractional charges, long before the physicist's fractional charge came up, namely, where atoms, individual atoms, isolated atoms, have a definite charge. When they are together, then, of course, charge will move from one atom to another, and the charge remaining in the volume assigned to an atom becomes fractional. So it's conceptually quite trivial, but practically was very important, because you then get important electrostatic energies that must be taken into account to understand phase diagrams and properties of alloys. So it was through this by observing that this charge distribution of the electrons, which is the same as the density distribution, was an interesting quantity, that I asked a quite simple question, namely, but again, already in this broadened framework, not just of external potentials due to nuclei, but arbitrary external potentials. And the question was, if I know the density distribution of the electrons, this curve up there, does that implicitly define everything about the system? For example, the 15th excited state. That seems absurdly implausible. But as I'll show you in a few lines, it's true. So that is the sense when I started. I said Tony's remark that the electrons are a cloud, in other words, just this density distribution, that is, on the one hand, both a rather trivial remark, and on the other hand, it's an incredibly far-reaching remark. And here's a lemma from which we started, namely, if there is a potential V of R which leads to the ground state density N of R, and now we take another potential, V prime of R, that also leads to N of R, then the lemma states without any qualifications that in fact these two potentials must be the same. Except for an additive constant. So a given density distribution comes from a unique external potential. The proof is quite trivial. One had to, of course, think about how I want to try and answer such a question. It's a very general kind of thing. And since I had some experience from my graduate student days with variational principles, that's the scheme that I started working on. Now I have to bring in Pierre Hornberg, who was well, we both sat in an enormous office, really a hall, occupied by Philippe Nozier, and there were in different corners, there were different people sitting. So I was sitting in one corner and Pierre was sitting in another corner. Of course, we became acquainted. And he was just, you know, like some persons at certain times of their lives, they're between marriages. He was in that situation. He had finished some work in Moscow, and he hadn't really started anything, and he didn't quite know what to do, and I was beginning to, well, prove this thing, and told him about it, and said, well, maybe you'd like to work with me on this, and so he did. So that's how that came about. The proof of it is on the next transparency, but what I'd like to do is just show you the transparency and not go through the proof now, but if there's interest and if there's time at the end, I'll go through it. I want to show it to you just to indicate to you that that's all there's to it, and it's really, the proof is a two-line proof. these two lines. So it's extremely simple. Now, what I said about the 15th Italian state seems totally absurd. On the other hand, I can convince you very easily, not quite truthfully, but very easily, that it's trivial. Why shouldn't it be possible? Why shouldn't it be so? I have two functions of a three-dimensional variable. N of r is one of them, and V of r is the other one. Now, you won't be surprised if I tell you that if I give you a system of electrons, you know the general nature of the Hamiltonian. And I also give you the external potential and the total number of electrons, that everything is determined. Now, why shouldn't there be a one-to-one mapping of the external potential on the density? And what this statement said, it's not exactly one-to-one, but apart from some tricky mathematical issues, very close to it, that the density does in fact determine the potential. Now, if you have the potential, you have the whole Hamiltonian. The density, of course, when integrated, gives you the total number of electrons. So, of course, everything is determined. So, from that standpoint, it's completely trivial. Except it's actually not quite true, but it's close to true. So that's what I'm saying on the next transparency. Since the density of the ground state determines the V of R, it determines the Hamiltonian, and hence, in principle, all quantities derivable from the Hamiltonian. The spectra, the wave functions, these many-body wave functions. Now, you know, this may remind some of you of a similar situation. You can get unbelievable patterns out of very simple instructions. So there's nothing, so to speak, absurd about the statement that the density in principle determines all these quantities. But it's an interesting statement, and it's a statement that people have made considerable use of. Okay. Now, I imagine everybody here knows about the Rayleigh-Ritz variational principle. I've referred to it in some of my earlier comments. Here it is. You have a Hamiltonian. I'm going back to wave functions for a moment. You have a Hamiltonian. Take expectation value in a trial function. And you have three operators: kinetic energy, external potential, interaction energy. Now, the expectation value of this external potential depends immediately only on the density. It's given here. The expectation value of the sum of these two operators is a universal functional of the density. What am I saying here? I just explained to you that the entire many-body wave function is determined by the density distribution. These operators are universal operators. This is just the Coulomb interaction, and this is the quantum mechanical kinetic energy operator. So therefore, this is a functional of the density. It does not explicitly depend on the potential. It is determined entirely by knowledge of the density. Pardon? No, psi is a functional of the density.
Psi is the ground set.
Ground set, right.
No, not the state.
Yes, no. I'm speaking about the ground set. I'll say a few words about excited states later. Now, so I can write the energy, which I've written here in terms of wave functions, and I'll rewrite it, and I use the prime for trial densities. This is the first term, and these are the other two terms. And here I have an expression for the ground state energy in terms of the density alone. And I can show very simply that if I substitute here the ground state density, not the one corresponding to the given V, but corresponding to some other V, that what I compute on the right-hand side with this other density is going to be larger than the true ground state density for the correct ground state energy, for the correct density. So this is very much the same, very analogous to the Rayleigh-Ritz principle in terms of the wave function. But what are the differences? It is now expressed entirely in terms of the density distribution, and instead of the explicit expression for the expectation value of the sum of these two terms in terms of the trial wave function, I now at this point only know that there exists such a functional, but I don't know how to compute it. And you may say, okay, you have just turned a very difficult problem into another very difficult problem, and you are spinning your wheels. I want to say here, maybe sort of a little general remark, which I learned in a conversation with Eugene Wigner, that turning a difficult and perhaps insoluble problem into another difficult and insoluble problem is not necessarily spinning your wheels. Okay? So we can discuss that later. In fact, Wigner said something else closely related to this. He said, you don't really understand any physics or any particular issue in physics unless you understand it from at least two quite different points of view. And this density functional theory, I am presenting to you, my view, as a different point of view for understanding electronic structure. Let's see, what this we have. I want to show you something else quickly. This F, you remember it represents kinetic energy and interaction energy. If I make the simplest approximation for the interaction energy, this classical expression here, and for the kinetic energy, I now adopt the picture of Thomas and Fermi, that it is locally the same as that of an homogeneous electron gas of the local density, and that's known what the kinetic energy is. It's homogeneous and non-interacting. If I put this in and minimize the energy with respect to n, this approximate energy with respect to n, I get back to Thomas Fermi theory. So you see that what has been done at this point, we have, so to speak, replace the original heuristic Thomas Fermi theory, heuristic and approximate, by a strict and in principle exact theory, in which, however, there enters now this functional about which we, at this point of my lecture, don't know anything. Okay. Now, in an analogous way, and this is where my other colleague, Lou Sham, comes in. When I came back from the sabbatical leave, he was already in San Diego as my postdoc, and we continued working in this area. And the question that we set ourselves was a very specific question. Since this variational principle in terms of density, in principle, is equivalent to the full Schrödinger equation. And since from the full Schrödinger equation, a very useful approximation that was derived, the Hartree approximation, in which the density incidentally plays a very important role. We wanted to see how can we get the Hartree equations out of that formal variational principle in which there are no wave functions at all. And I said to myself, well, if we can do this, we can no doubt go further because we have an formally exact starting point. And now this was done in the following way. We wrote this functional, remember it's the kinetic energy and interaction energy, in order to get something like the Hartree equations, we wrote it like the kinetic energy of non-interacting particles plus the classical interaction energy, but we know that that's of course not exact. So there's something left over. But since this is a functional of the density, and both of these are functions of the density, what is left over is also a functional of the density. So this equation now is the definition of this so-called exchange correlation energy. And from this, by just using the Eulerian equations from the variational principle, and by remembering that when you just strike this, you have the physics of the Hartree equations, we obtained these equations, Kohn-Sham equations, which look like the Hartree equations except for this term. This term is the functional derivative of this exchange correlation energy. Now, observations about these equations that I want to make are that if one, this is again an in principle observation, if the exact VXC is used, or were used would be a better way of putting it because you never had the exact VXC, but if it were used, these Hartree-like equations, which are of course equations for one body wave functions, give the exact density and the exact ground state energy, here's the expression for the ground state energy in this approach, including all many body effects. So just as the Thomas Fermi theory was an approximate theory that was, so to speak, developed into a formally exact theory in what I told you a few minutes ago, this variational principle in terms of the capital F. So now we, in a similar way, formally turn these rough Hartree equations into exact equations on the exact on the assumption that we have the exact the exchange correlation potential derivable by a functional differentiation of the exchange correlation energy. And now I want to raise a quick question. Is all this mathematics or is it natural science? And I, my view is that what I have done here, it was purely formal mathematics, although it was certainly very physically motivated. But it becomes a natural science when and only when it is used in conjunction with sufficiently simple and accurate approximations for these functionals that are only abstractly defined so far. We can't really do anything with it unless we have something there. Now these approximations, so the work I've described to you so far is roughly 35 years old, and there has been an enormous amount of work originally the very first work by ourselves, but then a very important work by a number of other people. I'll mention some names shortly. To develop sufficiently simple and at the same time accurate approximations for these functionals. These approximations come from outside of density functional theory. It is not a priori clear that such simple and accurate approximations exist. And it's the fact that the very first and simplest approximation right away gave extremely useful results that then gave the impetus to further work. So the simplest approximation, and I'm now going to talk about this EXC, that's the quantity, the unknown functional that you need in the for the Cohn-Sham equations. Most of the applications of density functional theory are through those single particle-like equations. Okay? Basically, we go back to this simplistic point of view of Thomas and Fermi. Here's the density distribution. And we say that the exchange correlation energy in the so-called local density approximation is given by an integral over all space of the exchange of an exchange correlation density that depends only on the local density. This is per particle times number of particles per unit volume and integrated. Now, in Thomas Fermi theory, this quantity was not present at all, but a similar picture was used for the kinetic energy. I'll come back to this transparency in a second. I just want to show you that the exchange correlation energy per particle has been, for a uniform electron gas, as function of the density of that gas, has been calculated originally, surprisingly accurately, by Wigner, and the best calculations today are obtained by Monte Carlo methods, so outside of density functional theory, and you get a function of one variable, exchange correlation energy per particle as a function of the uniform density. And here is what you get when you take that functional derivative for the exchange correlation energy. So to do a Cohn-Sham calculation in this approximation, you just put these two curves into your program, and otherwise it's the same as a Hartree calculation. Now, check my time. Okay. This very simple approximation. Let's see. I have a feeling this can be a little improved. How is this move? Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think I'm a little better now. So this approximation gives unexpectedly good results. We certainly knew that we were going to do much better than Hartree, because Hartree neglects this altogether. But we were did not expect that the results. And I write this again in the same sense. I'm sort of very rough with orders of magnitude. This is just to give you a general impression. And in case I forget it later, let me say right away that density functional theory is not a theory that today can give you very high accuracy. And I do not believe that it will ever give you very high accuracy. And for small molecules with conventional wave function methods, well, I mentioned that already for the hydrogen molecule, you can get accuracies of a tiny fraction of a percent. With density functional theory, the accuracies are in this range. And I say also right now, in case I forget it later, that where the theory, apart from giving you a different viewpoint and focusing on the density distribution rather than on orbitals, where it is practically useful is for large molecules, when you generally don't need an accuracy of four places, and where wave function, traditional wave function methods simply can't reach. So it gives surprisingly good results considering how crude this is. It is used in 99% of applications to solids. That's probably still true. No harder than Hartree, much better, much easier than Hartree-Fock, typically similar or better accuracy. Hartree-Fock, of course, excludes correlation effects, whereas here, in some rough way, they are included. Now, one line of development over the last decades, which has been scientifically very interesting, are so-called gradient corrections. Naturally, this idea that the exchange correlation energies can just be obtained by this picture of a locally uniform gas is, of course, oversimplified. And naturally, the simplest thing to do is to introduce gradients of the density, and not just the local density. Now, the most trivial thing to do is to do a plain gradient expansion. That doesn't work at all in practice, and the reason is simply that the gradients that you find in molecules or in solids are simply too big for having such an expansion to be well convergent. It appears, and that is at least my rationalization, that we are talking here about something like a asymptotically convergent series, and as you know, things get better at first and then they get worse again, and for real systems, as they occur in nature, the place where things seem to be getting worse again is just about here, the first term. So this is, of course, a complication. You need to know this quantity, and it, on the average, doesn't buy you anything. Some results in comparison with the experiment are improved, some are made worse. But there's been a very interesting and very successful development, and these are some of the key people here. Two physicists, Langreth and Perdue, and Becker is trained as a physicist but works in a chemistry department. And they have introduced this notion of the generalized gradient expansion, so it's similar to this local density approximation where you integrate over all space and you integrate with a function of n only, and they generalize that to a function of n and delta n, gradient of n. Now, the question now is, what is this function? And here a great deal of very, very thoughtful work has gone into this. With important results. In fact, to again give you a little bit of the recent history, the local density approximation was already extremely useful to condensed matter theorists from the very beginning, and they used it right away, because they did not, they could find very useful results without having a very high degree of accuracy. Another thing is that in a solid you don't have edge effects, whereas in a molecule, the molecule has edges, and the local density approximation is particularly questionable near the edges. So solid state physicists use density functional theory almost right away, and in the form of the local density approximation. This didn't help. Then over the next decades, people like the ones that I've written down and many others worked in this spirit and thought very deeply about the physics of interacting electrons in a non-uniform system, and came up with such major improvements in accuracy that at that point, approximately 10 years ago, chemists became very interested in the subject. And that's, you know, if you want to know, want to try and understand why the Nobel Committee gave me this prize in chemistry, that's how it happened. So, there are hybrid approximations, which are combinations of full exchange and LDA. Very thoughtful, and they've made the difference. I want to again just flash a transparency to show you that what I've discussed now, which was for a ground state of a simple electronic system, has been generalized in many directions, and I just read through this and leave it to the discussion if anybody wants to pick up any of these things. Degenerate ground states, spin density functional theory, spin where one talks about a two density system, a two fluid system, a spin up density, spin down density, magnetism generally, multi-component systems. There's a little sub-industry that applies density functional theory to nuclei, to electron hole drops in semiconductors. Finite temperature extension was made by Merman. That's used extensively for plasma research. Excited states, first logically interesting work was by a Greek physicist, Theophilo, and we followed up on that. Orbital magnetism, where one needs to introduce not only the density, but also the current density, and here are the authors. Superconductors, again, a formal two-fluid theory, a normal fluid and a superfluid. Again, formally exact. Incidentally, that's only for, this does not handle electron-phonon interactions. It handles only electron-electron interactions, so presumably is relevant to high-TC superconductors. There's some interesting work going on now in Bristol using density functional theory for high-TC superconductors. Relativistic generalization, time-dependent generalization, Runge and Gross. The ideas of density functional theory are not limited to fermions, has been applied to bosons. Let me remind you again, it never tells you anything about a homogeneous system. It tells you something about a system that's inhomogeneous, and it uses input from studies of homogeneous systems or of systems with some simple systems with density gradients. Very important, so surface of liquid helium, there of course you have an inhomogeneity, and that's been used with success. A very original idea was due to these two Italian physicists, Carr and Parinello, a little over 10 years ago, perhaps it's almost 15 now, who combined density functional theory with molecular dynamics in an abstract sense, and this has been particularly helpful for systems where the geometry of the nuclei is not known or very, very incompletely known in advance. In their approach, the density distribution, the Rancid energy, and the geometry are simultaneously determined. And a number of formal advances. So that's just to indicate to you the scope of this theory today. Quantitative results, and yes, I'm over time, so I will again leave this perhaps to discussion, mention here things that I have in my briefcase that I can show you if you're interested: atomic energies, ionization potentials, few atomic molecules, clusters, and then quite differently, large molecules. I've shown you pictures of them, bulk metals, metal surfaces, spin magnetism, in solid state physics, band structure of solids has been important. And skipping the numerical tables, and I just summarize with these GGAs, generalized gradient approximations. Here is the kind of accuracy that has been obtained. I'm taking these results from Becke, somebody I mentioned earlier. Dissociation energies of molecules with this kind of accuracy. Best CI calculations for this set of standard set of molecules are more accurate. These are small molecules, and so I remind you again that for small molecules, if you want high accuracy, standard methods are the way to go. If you want high accuracy and have lots of computer time available. On the other hand, this kind of accuracy is now not very far from this. 10 years ago, it was the difference was a factor, another factor of three. So this, for many purposes, is already extremely useful. An interesting fact that, if you ask me to explain it, I'm not in a position to, but it's a matter of experience in these calculations, that the geometry, the distances, for example, the simplest would be in a diatomic molecule. What is the distance, equilibrium distance between the atoms? Or for a more complicated molecule, what is the whole geometric configuration? That comes out very, very accurately, about the same in both methods, with an accuracy of something like 1 or 2 × 10⁻²² angstroms. So for structural calculations, density functional theory has been quantitatively extremely useful. And that brings me to the end. Concluding remarks. Traditional methods, Hartree-Fock and configuration interaction, very successful and accurate for small systems up to something on the order of 10 atoms. Definitely not 50. It can be systematically improved, but encounters an exponential wall. It's often said, and correctly, that the CI methods, you just add more determinants and you're going to get a better result. But I've indicated to you that it's a little bit like Zeno's paradox. You get to a point where you can increase your basis by a factor of 10 and you may be able to add one more electron to your calculation. So in density functional theory, well, I guess I come to it now. Density functional theory is less accurate, that kind of accuracy, for small systems, but can be applied to much larger systems. So at the present time, density functional methods have been successfully applied to systems of hundreds and up to 1,000 particles. Improvements are not as systematic as in the traditional methods, or routine, right? And traditional methods, the simplest thing is just increase your bases. But they are continuing, and they yield all kinds of physical or chemical insight on the way. The two points of view are, in my view, complementary, and I believe they enrich physics and chemistry. Current areas of progress, yes, and I, of course, there's work in many directions. These happen to be three areas that I personally am interested in and I'm working with several people on. Did Ann Mattson come, or did she stay home with her cold? She's at home. Okay. So here I'm working with Ann Mattson on this and on this, and I'm working with a couple of people, not on this campus, on van der Waals type energies. And before I thank you for your attention, I want to show you what a friend of mine thought of my conversion from physics to chemistry. This gentleman is a retired professor of art history. This says, chemistry made easy. Thank you. That is my position, yes, that's correct.
Question? This is a question about your statement. Your model of computation was a classical model. Have you considered the possibility that it may be possible to build a quantum computational device in the next few decades that might be able to break the exponential wall and actually store the information as well as computing your state?
Well, you know, if quantum, the exponential wall will remain. It is inherent in the nature of the system. Now, if your tool becomes exponentially stronger, it may overcome that wall. So the real question now is, what is my view of the future of quantum computation? I don't have an educated view. Yes, we should worry about it. And as a matter of fact, I am working with a gentleman in France at the moment in that area. I think somewhere along my talk, I indicated that there were some problems, and that is one of the problems. Now, there is a considerable amount of empirical accumulation of empirical facts about this question. That so perhaps I repeat the issue. The issue is, are there density distributions that look perfectly decent, but cannot be produced by any external potential as ground state densities? Well, first of all, the answer to that question is yes, there are. There are examples. The examples that exist are all associated with degeneracies, with degenerate ground states. The topology of in this functional space of densities, of where the difficulties occur and where they do not occur, is not mapped out at this point. There are just a few points known, but there are very few examples that do not involve degeneracies where there's any reason to suspect the problem.
Other questions? Well, that's thanks all again.